Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Dialogue, a podcast sponsored by the Society for Novel Studies and produced in partnership with Public Books, an online magazine of arts, ideas, and scholarship. I'm Sarah Wasserman, one of your hosts this season. On this podcast, we bring scholars and novelists together to talk about how novels work, how they're written, read, studied, and remembered. But this season is a bit different, as we're focusing on how novels get translated. All season long, we're bringing together novelists, translators, and critics to talk about what happens when novels and novelists move from one language to another. Today, I have the honor of welcoming Professor Brent Edwards and translator and publisher Jean-Baptiste Nody. They'll be talking today about the novels of Claude McKay, the Jamaican-American writer whose poetry and novels shaped the Harlem Renaissance and offered readers a complex treatment of race, place, and politics. Brent and Jean-Baptiste will be talking about translating McKay into French, sometimes translating McKay out of French, and also about translating McKay's scholarship into French. Brent Edwards is the Peng Family Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. He is the author of the prize-winning Epistrophes, Jazz, and the Literary Imagination, and the Practice of Diaspora, Literature, Translation, and the Rise of Black Internationalism. With Jean-Christophe Cloutier, Brent edited Claude McKay's Amiable with Big Teeth. His many translations include essays, poems, and fictions by authors such as Edouard Glissant, Aimé Césaire, Jacques Derrida, Jean Baudrillard, and Michel Léris. In 2020, Brent was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he is joining us today from New York. Jean-Baptiste Nody is a publisher and translator from Paris, France. He translated to French African Journey by Aslanda Good-Robison in 2020 and Amiable with Big Teeth by Claude McKay in 2021. He has also recently translated An Archaeology of Holes, a short story collection by the South African writer Stacey Hardy, which came out with his publishing house, Rotbokriek. He co-founded Rotbokriek in 2021. It's an independent publishing house based in Set. Jean-Baptiste is a man of many talents and has played a number of roles in the past. He's been a bookseller, he founded Société Réaliste, an art cooperative, and as an artist, he's exhibited his own work in exhibitions around the world. And he joins us today from an undisclosed location in France. So thank you for joining us. My real job here is to get out of the way and let the two of you do the talking. So I'd like to begin just by posing a very general question to both of you, which is, what is it that drew you initially to Claude McKay? And perhaps more importantly, what is it that keeps drawing you to his work?
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to do this and fun to be able to chat with Jean-Baptiste about McKay and about our continuing transatlantic dialogue around McKay's work. I guess I'd say from my own perspective, I was first drawn to McKay because I was attracted to, as a young intellectual, even before I went to graduate school, attempting to write myself, but also a young expat. I lived in France before I came back to the U.S. to go to graduate school, and I was attracted to the vagabond, the peripatetic nature of McKay's life, his travels, his wanderings, his errancies around the globe. And that he, as his autobiography is titled, spent so much of his life a long way from home. So that was the first, to me, as an expatriate, for the same reason that I'd carried with me on the plane to Paris when I first moved to France in the early 1990s, James Baldwin's The Price of the Ticket, Baldwin's complete essays. McKay was part of my very small three or four bookshelf. When I moved to Paris the first time, he was one of the authors that I felt had to come with me as part of the baggage. Jean-Baptiste, what attracted you to McKay?
Well, I discovered McKay by chance, I guess, like a lot of French readers, because at the time when I was studying at the university, I was studying around Francophone Black literature. Of course, I had to work a lot around Negritude and around Aimé Césaire and Senghor and Damas, etc., and the Nardal sisters. Not so much at that time, actually, but and studying those writers, it was clear that Black American literature had a strong influence on them. And that's when I heard for the first time about McKay. And when I was a student at Sorbonne, actually, there was only one book back by McKay that was available in French, which was Bonjour. That was just retranslated at that time in Marseille by a Marseille publisher called André Dimanche. And so it was a very specific period when McKay had completely disappeared from the French panorama. And there was this effort by this Marseille publishing house to try to bring him back, and first via the Marseille trope, actually. So this idea that Banjo, which is set in Marseille, which is one of the most famous novel about Marseille, even for French readers, I mean, could lead to the rediscovery of McKay in France. And actually, André Dimanche, this publisher, some years after retranslating and publishing again Banjo, did the same for A Long Way From Home. So this was my first encounter with McKay. And then I have to say that I was part of the, I was in the middle of this wave of renewed interest for McKay in the French readership that started maybe 3 or 4 years ago, something like that. And of course, I mean, I have to give credit when credit is due, reading your book, Brent, The Practice of Diaspora, where the central chapter about McKay and vagabond writing was extremely powerful to me. And so gave me also the urge to go and read McKay in English and to try also to discover in McKay, in the English writing of McKay, English language writing, the polyphony that was at work within his work. The fact that he was a Jamaican was of a lot of interest for me, especially what kind of approach he could have of the some kind of imperial language like English is from a Jamaican point of view, compared to what happened to the French language at the same period under the eye and the scope of West Indian writers or African writers, how they used the imperial language in a certain way. And I was willing to try to see and to detect in the way McKay approached novel writing or poetry, of course, the same problem. The French are telling themselves a story about race relations, a story in which the American experience and specifically the African-American experience has a very important part. So the United States played the role in the French imaginary of this epitome of racism. So this kind of definitive example of what anti-blackness is, and the fascination of the French for African-American literature and for African-American, let's say, culture in general, is very much related to the denial of a specific French racism. And there is a part of the story of African-American writers in France that they can interpret in this way. So they keep on feeling that if all those very important writers from McKay to Baldwin to Chester Himes, and even very important figures like Nina Simone and very key figures of the African-American culture of the 20th century came to France, it was supposedly because France was a less racist country than the United States, than such things as anti-blackness could not exist in our country. And so I think that it's a very crucial aspect if one wants to understand why McKay now has such an important let's say renaissance in France.
Yeah, it strikes me that there's an interesting, you could call it a misrecognition of McKay as African American, in the way that a French readership takes him up and a French publishing industry takes him up. One of the things I write about in my diaspora book is the excerpt from Banjo that's published in Légitime Défense, the incendiary journal put out by a group of Martinican students in the early 1930s. And they title this excerpt from Banjo, this book by a Jamaican author about Black communities in Marseille. They title it L'étudiant entier vu par un noir américain. So the Caribbean student as seen by a Black American. And they miss, in this very interesting but very symptomatic way, the fact that the main character who's featured in this excerpt, because the excerpt is from a chapter where the main character meets a Martinican student, the main character in the novel, in both of McKay's first two novels, In Home to Harlem and Banjo, is Haitian, Ray. So what you're actually getting in McKay is a much more complex and much more critical portrait of inter-imperial dynamics and even inter-Francophone dynamics, where we have a French Caribbean but Haitian character in Ray confronting a French Caribbean Martinican, still a colonial subject, figure in the student that he's talking to. And the French interestingly missed that or allied that in making McKay representative of the Harlem Renaissance. It used to be, I mean, maybe I should ask you, Jean-Baptiste, what if you had a conversation with Place, with the publisher about this. It used to be that books would say, I think it's changed now, but it used to be that books in France translated, American books that were translated in French would say traduit de l'américain. So translated from American English, as opposed to traduit du, I think it used to say Britannique, from British English. And yours, your version of Amiable with Big Teeth, I think it's now the convention that it says traduit de l'anglais, and then in parentheses, États-Unis. So translated from English, United States. But even that, there's something complex going there, because that little prefatory frame put up at the front of the book says that there's a certain kind of English that's moving, that's being carried over. When, of course, with a novel like Banjo, or even a book like Amiable with Big Teeth, which is set in New York, but equally involves diasporic communities, involves Ethiopians interacting with Black folks of Caribbean descent who have moved from the South to the North, various kinds of Englishes. And there's an interesting kind of fudging of that. Did you talk about that with Cyril, with the publisher, when you were working on your translation?
Well, I insisted on presenting McKay as a Jamaican writer. So I knew that at a certain point in his life he had the American nationality, but the fact that he was from Jamaica for me was crucial. And the fact of using this expression, which is standard in French now, like translated from English and between parentheses, United States, in a certain way opens up a little this idea, if you compare to translated from American, because we can say that in French, traduit de l'américain. So because McKay, of course, was educated in a British colony, and was raised in a British colony. So for me, the fact that he was a Jamaican was very important in presenting him to the French readership. That was a very clear idea, maybe a little bit too clear, about what the Jamaican is supposed to be. And that is something very different from an American. But I think it's very interesting what you say about the fact that in Légitime Défense, he was presented as Ray, the Haitian character, was misread as an American, because I think it has a lot of relation. I mean, it relates to a certain way this international Blackness has been constructed from the point of view of the French Empire. So it was very important for me in terms of this translation to insist on the fact that McKay was a Jamaican, especially because people that know McKay in France, they know him as an African-American writer in France. So, and not so much as a West Indian. And then regarding to the way of mentioning the language of translation, I would have considered a little bit excessive to call it translated from Jamaican English. This would have been a little bit too much, especially because McKay wrote in Jamaican English, in Patois, a book of poetry. It was the first book ever published in Patois, actually. So this would be some kind of, let's say, an excessive way of understanding it. So, and I guess it's interesting to have a Jamaican writer writing in English in the American context after being in Europe. So this, I mean, looks a lot like McKay, like something very, very peripatetic, you said, a very vagabond way of understanding language and identities.
Yeah, I guess what fascinates me about it and what seems interestingly off is that to me, McKay, going back to what draws me to McKay, if anything, McKay is about a confrontation among Englishes, all of McKay. You never have just American English or just Jamaican English or just expatriate English, whatever that would be. You have Englishes. There is no just US English or just English, British English. That's what I find fascinating about McKay. And in Banjo, in the story swapping scenes and the arguments on the quay in Marseille, part of what you're hearing is this stew of languages, of versions of English and other languages coming into contact. So it's an interesting thing to try to put him in a national box, this writer in particular, to say this book is American English in particular. I'm also fascinated by what that does to the way McKay becomes influential for, going back to what I was saying about Légitime Défense, for the negritude generation, for the Black French intellectuals, for the writers who become the so-called fathers of negritude, who read McKay and take him as a tutelary influence, as kind of a pedagogical text or set of texts around what it means to think Black consciousness. But they're reading McKay through this particular lens that warps him in interesting ways in a way that becomes formative. It's not exactly a right or wrong thing. It's about the way something becomes formative as it moves. So I, again, in my diaspora book, I talk about the fact that the first translator of Banjo, Paul Vaillant-Couturier, is a French communist politician, actually, in the early 1930s. And every time McKay uses words like folk and common people, Vaillant-Couturier uses in French, le prolétariat, the proletariat. He translates some of the terms that McKay uses quite often. Of course, proletariat is a word in English, but McKay writes words like folk and common people all the time. And if you read that early version of Banjo, Vaillant-Couturier translates it in that direction. It's not so much about getting it wrong. It's more, to me, the interesting question is, what does it mean that this is the McKay with le prolétariat, with the proletariat injected, that Léopold Senghor, that Aimé Césaire, that they're reading McKay in French? And this is the McKay that they're being influenced by. One example in Amiable with Big Teeth that I was going to ask you about Jean-Baptiste is, it's in the chapter, The Emperor's Letter. It's when the Ethiopian envoy, Lij Alamaya, he's gone to Harlem to try to raise support and to raise funds for the Ethiopian cause after Ethiopia has been invaded by Mussolini's Italy. And he has a letter from the emperor, from Haile Selassie, authenticating him as an envoy, saying, I've sent you as my envoy to raise money. And he goes to this gathering and shows the letter, and it gets stolen by the bad guy of the book, the evil communist. but this is a detail from that chapter. They're chatting about it. Lij Alamaya pulls out the letter. There's an English guy, and it's interesting, going back to what we were saying about McKay being a British imperial subject, that McKay makes this person a white Englishman. rather than any of the other characters who are in the room. And a white Englishman whose name is Pickett, Aubrey Pickett, they're having this conversation, and the African-American woman who's kind of chaperoning the Ethiopian envoy, Alamaya, has brought him late because she says, "You always show up at parties late. We've got to be late." And it's the English guy who says when they come in the door, "Oh, I see already you're keeping CPT." And I was really interested to see what you'd do with that, because CPT to me is a very African-American, it's a very U.S. Black English idiom, color people's time. And it's hard to handle in French because there's not quite an equivalent to it. And what you ended up putting is, je vois que vous êtes à l'heure africaine. You're keeping African time. I'm not sure how else you could do it, because you can't just do a literal translation of the idiom, which loses its idiomaticity, that it has a specific meaning in African-American vernacular English. But African time is tricky too, because what happens in the scene is this tension between the meaning of colored, African, and black, because Lij Alamaya, the Ethiopian, is standing there and thinking, well, I think of myself as African, but I don't quite think of myself as colored. So why is this white English guy telling me I'm keeping colored people's time? I'm African, but I'm not colored, is actually what the way the passage unfolds. So it's a very hard passage to translate. I'm not sure it's about finding some, as though there could be some perfect or exact equivalent. The whole point is that there is not an exact equivalent. And in the original passage, part of the dynamic is that there is not exact equivalence, right? Lij Alamaya is not quite getting it. It's CPT is not, he doesn't quite get that. And it's the white English guy trying to pretend to be cool, who's saying, yeah, I know what CPT means. It's the white guy who's throwing this black vernacular term into the conversation. But the whole conversation in English, in the novel, is about this linguistic discrepancy, that idioms don't necessarily carry over, that even in Anglophone contexts, they're not necessarily transparent. So it's not about some right version of that Jean-Baptiste could have found. It's about the work of these discrepancies that travel and reshape things in these very interesting ways. I wonder, well, you were laughing as I mentioned it. I wonder, you must have wrestled with it. I wonder how you came up with the solution you came up with.
And you have to say that right after this mentioning CPT, Aubrey Pickett, this Englishman, is turning to African Americans that are here and saying, "Oh, but you should explain him what CPT is." And none of the African Americans that are here understand what that means.
And they don't know.
So they don't know, because they are from the upper class, let's say, part of Harlem, and for them, it's they miss the point. So I completely agree with what you say, and in this precise case, my point was not to, let's say, use a literal translation that could have worked in a way, because French people now have an understanding of African American culture that could have made it understandable, let's say. But I wanted to reproduce the colonial gaze that was at stake here. And if you would have compared in time, you know, like in a French speaking context, what would an Englishman like that say to an African in France while he would be with French speaking African people or West Indians? It would have been this. So African time, l'heure africaine, le temps africain. And so I inverted the effect. So in a way, it's not aggregating Lij Alamaya to this African-American concept of, or let's say American context of CPT, but it's agglomerating in this version, this French version. So those African-Americans to a colonial African understanding. So they are reduced. I mean, their blackness is there reduced to their Africanness. So they are in a way associated to something that is completely outside of their reality, because they are absolutely not Africans, and especially compared to this Ethiopian guy. So this was my choice to try to keep the brutality of this pun or this joke, and that triggers a reaction then, because like the Liege Alamaya becomes a little bit aggressive in his way. He's a very mild guy, but he has some kind of reaction after this consideration. So what most of translators do when it's about translating African American vernacular English is that they use let's say popular French, which sounds like actually white worker French. So the question of race is erased there, but I think it's inevitable. You cannot reassess the race dimension while translating this aspect.
Well, as we were talking about before, you could say that there's a McKay vogue or a wave or a resurgence or a renaissance of interest in McKay over the past couple of years. Part of that, understandably, is due to the rediscovery and first publication of these previously unknown books of Amiable with Big Teeth and with Romance in Marseille. So to that degree, it may be an understandable feature of literary history. But as Jean-Baptiste was saying earlier, the interesting thing is that you could say there are multiple waves. Waves aren't in literary history, in publishing history, waves aren't permanent, because publishers go out of business, because things go in and out of print. So I thought that was when I was starting my teaching career as an assistant professor, when Michel Fabre retranslated Banjo and A Long Way From Home. That felt like a wave right around the millennium. Those are 1999, and A Long Way From Home he translated, I think, around 2001.
Exactly.
And I was in contact with Michel because I was doing research in France around then, and remember thinking, wow, here's McKay coming back into view. Waves, I think it's important to realize that waves are not permanent. And the other thing I think it's important to realize that's hard to talk about, it's interesting how difficult it is to talk about, is that chronology shifts in translation. Some things come out in sequence, but there's this interesting skewing of the chronology, a reordering of the corpus. W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk wasn't translated until 1959. What does that do for a French understanding of African-American racial politics? Zora Neale Hurston, Their Eyes Were Watching God, was not translated until 1996. I was just reading, it was retranslated recently, Sika Fakambi's translation a couple of years ago of Their Eyes Are Watching God in 2018. An extraordinary, I think as a translation, an extraordinary performance, because she doesn't do what you were talking about, Jean-Baptiste. She doesn't fall into the pitfall of replicating a kind of proletarian French as a version of a vernacular French, of conflating race with class that way. She finds a way of inventing a vernacular that's not a West African or a Caribbean French or a Creolized French, but she invents a vernacular that gets close to what Hurston does with English. But that book only came out a couple of years ago. Nella Larsen wasn't translated until about a decade ago. Passing and Quicksand were not available in French until around 2010. Jean Toomer wasn't translated until the 1970s, Kane. So what we might take for granted about the canon does not move in the chronological shape that we tend to take for granted in thinking about the shape of a tradition. Jean-Baptiste, I don't know if you've thought about it this way, and I, as in preparing for our conversation, I was just looking over some of the history and thinking about this in relation to McKay, because I was thinking, what does McKay mean now in relation to the emergence of a Black consciousness in France, beyond just the fact of the discovery of Amiable and the first publishing of Romance in Marseille, why is McKay coming back into view? But then I started thinking about it and realizing that the chronology is shifting as it moves over. I don't know if you've thought about it this way, if what I'm saying makes sense.
Absolutely. I would say that the French history with McKay is really an history with banjo, actually. So this book influenced a lot the Negritude movement. This book was the first one published by McKay in France. This book was the only one that had some kind of public recognition, much more than Home to Harlem or Banana Bottom. And of course, it's the opposite than the American context, where Home to Harlem was the main book, the main novel of McKay. And when Home to Harlem was translated in France in 1932, the approach was really, so in this kind of proletarian literature framing, let's have some kind of exotic view on this African district or black district in New York. And the title chosen for the translation at the time was Quartier Noir, Black District. So there was a kind of exotic approach of it. And then in 2021, so last year, there were those two publications of unknown books by McKay. So Romance in Marseille and Amiable was Big Teeth. And so this is kind of a funny situation. So you can understand in the American context, everybody has the access to the whole oeuvre of McKay, and suddenly two unknown books appear and are published, and they are in this kind of continuity. In France, it's completely different. So nobody was reading McKay except Banjo, that had this specific status. And then suddenly those two unknown books by McKay happen to be published, but all the other books of McKay are completely unknown as well, you know? And so now starts a new trend because of the success of Romance in Marseille and of the recognition of Amiable with Big Teeth. And now they start republishing the whole oeuvre. No. So that's interesting about chronology and publishing edition and publishing history, and about the very interest renewed interest in McKay. I think it's very very much related to contemporary issues and political issues of our days, because for some years now the anti-racist movement in France has been let's say strengthened. Very much politicized, very much in a lot of positive and productive way radicalized, and so people, militants or not, are looking for sources and cultural elements on which to build, and the very specific and to that extent, the history of the African American political movement has always been very influential in France to that aspect. Very interesting to see the influence of Fanon on the Black Panther and reciprocally how the Black Panther shaped a lot of racial consciousness and understanding of political issue in France in the 70s, 80s. And so there is some kind of looking after those key figures of the anti-racist corpus.
I'll add just one thing. I agree with everything you said, but the other thing I'd add is that it's interesting to think about McKay's work, and especially these recent republications, as a Marseille focused corpus. So it's giving, in the French context, it's giving a vision of a French cosmopolitanism, a French worldliness that's insistently Mediterranean. I mean, yes, it's about the African diaspora. It's about vagabonds and dockers and wanderers meeting up on the docks, on the quays in Marseille. But that it's Marseille, not Paris. And McKay, as we know, was really did not care for Paris. He spent some time there, but he was not attracted to the cafe life, the dilettante life of the Parisian sidewalk scene. So in the French context, it gives an interesting counterpoint to Marseille famously is always the other city, the alternative to Paris, since the French conception of itself is so centralized, the metropole is so capital focused, that Mackay is a Marseille focused France, that I think is part of the mix that's really interesting.
Yeah, I would say to that extent. So we had some kind of political debate last year, because as you might know, we have something called the Pantheon, where we put the ashes of important people as defined by the French government. And so last year, as some kind of answer to the current rise of the anti-racist movement, which is strongly opposed, of course, to our government, so the government had this brilliant idea to put in the Pantheon Josephine Baker, which is the embodiment of, for them at least, of this African-American exile to Paris, you know, and this refuge far away from segregation in the land of the free, of freedom, that Paris is supposed to be. And that's interesting to that extent that I think Mackay also, in a way, the reason why he chose Marseille, so it's probably for very practical reason that he didn't have no money, so he couldn't really stay in Paris. It was very difficult for him at that time, and he had some connection that led him to the south of France. But also because in Marseille, he met with what was of interest for him at that period, which was this colonial diaspora, that Marseille is the embodiment. In France, like, for example, we have various sayings about Marseille that pretend that Marseille is an African city, is the beginning of Africa, you know, in the colonial conception of space, because it's a colonial harbor and open to North Africa, it's the first step to Africa.
Well, I feel like the two of you have, I don't know, for me, sketched this Mackay multiverse would be the word of the moment, but that there are so many Mackays and so many Englishes and so many sites that the work touches on and convenes upon. And of course, we could talk for so many more minutes, but it's my job to sort of wrap things up by asking you our podcast signature question. And this season, it's about translation. And I think it will actually return us to some of the things that we were talking about earlier in the show. And so ironically, in the season about translation, it's a question about what defies translation. And it's a question I'm sure you've heard before, which is there a word or a concept that you consider untranslatable or very difficult to translate?
It would be an entirely other conversation, which we probably don't have time to have. I admit to some frustration with the untranslatability debates, because to me, even if we read that work on untranslatability, the theorists who introduce the term define it's admittedly openly a catachresis. It's a misnomer. It's a word used misleadingly, because untranslatability, as Cassin defines it, doesn't mean you can't translate it. It means you keep trying to translate it. It's the word that you keep coming back to, that you keep wrestling with. And that, to me, is the point, although I wouldn't call it untranslatability, because it's not exactly untranslatable. It's the thing that you have to keep translating, retranslating, keep working at. As a translator, untranslatability is perplexing and simply unacceptable. As a translator, Jean-Baptiste, I think, will agree, you don't have the option of untranslatability. You can cushion, you can graft, you can contextualize, you can provide a glossary, a footnote, you can put a word in brackets, you can show some of the difficulties of translation, but you can't not translate. As a translator, you're in the room, you're in the pages of the book to carry over. So you have to find a solution. If you don't believe, as I was saying before, that the task of the translator is to find some pristine, perfect one-to-one correspondence between original and translation, then it's not a matter of fidelity. It's not a matter of a perfect match. It's a matter of the work you do when you carry it over and inherently, unavoidably change it in the process. But you don't have the option of saying, I prefer not to, in Bartleby's phrase. You got to find a solution. As a translator, you're doing, when I was translating Michel Eris, there were particular phrases I struggled with. We know that idiomatic phrases, that jokes, that there are particular registers of language that are hard to translate, but you don't have the option of just not doing it or saying that's untranslatable. You've got to find a way to do it. So to me, the term, I don't find the term helpful, opening up a space of questioning, because it doesn't get you to the real work of translation, which is the task of facing the necessity and impossibility of translation, always going together. That's my answer. That's as quick an answer as I can give.
Yeah, I can make a kind of double answer for myself. We were talking about The Wretch of the Earth by Fanon, and I find very interesting that in the English translation of Fanon, the term blackness happens a lot. It is reiterated a lot. And this word does not exist in French. So the translator to English chose to amalgamate things that Fanon were saying to this very English language concept of blackness. And the other way, when we have to translate books that deal with blackness, we are struggling, trying to find something instead of blackness. So some translators do not translate it, which is not a solution for me, of course. Like as Brent just said, as a translator, you have to do something. But there are so many options and so many ways of translating blackness. There is no equivalent, no good solution. So it's always the best error you can make. Something like that. So I go to my second point, which is actually a reference to Brent's book, The Practice of Diaspora. But there is a whole part, very beautiful and mesmerizing for me, about a French word called décalage. Décalage. So a word that is not translatable in English, and that is absolutely crucial to the understanding of the practice of translation. So this décalage, so means lagging something, or in a way, some kind of something that doesn't fit very much, doesn't fit as well as it could, and that is inescapable. And translation is about that, is about décalage. So you have to find temporary solutions. No, and that's why retranslating is so important in a way, because of course you cannot translate McKay the same in the 30s or in the 90s or now or in 30 years from now. So we have to keep on translating, and English translator have to keep on translating Fanon and again and again and again to reappropriate it, change it, loot him in a way. So I think that's very important.
Yeah, the waves have to keep coming, obviously. And I really like the phrase, Jean-Baptiste, that you offered us, the best error you can make.
and keep following those ripples, like, right? Because it moves into, it shapes the tradition of the debates and the discourse of French philosophy.
Thanks to both of you. Thanks to Brent and Jean-Baptiste. In addition to reading McKay, which we hope you will, you can find Brent and Jean-Baptiste's books and translations online and visit Rotbokrik at rotbokrik.com. As always, we are grateful to the Society for Novel Studies for its sponsorship, to Public Books for its partnership, and we acknowledge the support of Duke University. Hannah Jorgensen is our graduate intern, and Connor Hibbard is the sound engineer. Novelists from past seasons include Chang-Rai Lee, Teju Cole, Ruth Ozeki, Jennifer Egan, George Saunders, and many more. On November 17th, tune in for this season's finale, in which host Arthi Vade talks with Saskia Zielokowski and Anne Goldstein, the translator of Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan Quartet. From all of us at Novel Dialogue, thanks so much for tuning in. Keep listening and keep reading.